Sportsnet and Sportsnet 590 The Fan present Point Taken, a podcast connecting you to the sports and pop culture issues you care about and the guests you want to hear more from. Now, here's Carolyn Cameron and Greg Brady.
Hey, everybody. Yeah, welcome to the podcast. Carolyn here and Greg. I just returned from New York City. I was there on vacation and
name dropping. Hold on,
city name dropping. I'm starting with a story.
Okay. I'm excited you're back.
So I was, I was there on vacation. Then it turned into a work trip with Denis Shapovalov reaching the fourth round. So I went to cover that. And you know what? As much fun as I had in New York, I have to say I'm happy to be home because I know this sounds cliche or everyone says cab drivers in New York are terrifying. I honestly had the most terrifying driving experience of my life on the cab ride back from Flushing Meadows to downtown.
That's a long ride, first of all. Why didn't you take the 7 train? It's an expensive ride. What did you pay?
No, it actually wasn't.
It was
like
40 bucks.
Yeah, and we split up amongst three people.
Oh, that's reasonable. Okay, fine.
Anyway, and then I had a really bad experience, too, just getting lost on the New York City subway.
Tell us about the drive first. What was there a bumper
Oh, yeah. I've never been in a car where someone's driving so fast, and I regret... Me and my friends regret not just getting out.
And you didn't feel...
But you're on a bridge and you're...
Well, it's awkward to tell the driver
to
stop driving.
Well, and I didn't want to upset him or distract him or we would have... Anyway, I like New York, but I prefer to walk.
But that's also a long walk from your hotel out to Flushing Meadows, right?
Other than that, though, it was a great trip. And U.S. Open was fun. And Denis really was the talk of the tournament.
Now, that's your first U.S. Open experience live?
No, I went.
You've gone before.
I went in 2010. I went with my mom.
Okay.
And that was, that was
And who'd
fun.
You get to see the first time around?
You know what?
It's been a long time since I've been there.
Oh, you know what? I saw on, I think it was Louis Armstrong, it was James Blake against Peter Polansky.
That's
in
not
2010.
A bad match.
Yeah. But yeah, no, it was really fun. Saw Nadal this time around.
Yeah.
Saw Denis, obviously. I watched his whole fourth round match, so... All in all, it was good fun as we get set for Davis Cup that coming up in just over a week from
now. That's right, on Sportsnet in Edmonton against India to advance, back to the World Group?
Yeah, to stay in the World Group.
Yeah, the loser gets relegated, basically.
But yeah,
right?
Regardless of if you're a tennis fans, you should go to the U.S. Open because, to me, the U.S. Open's like Disney World for tennis fans. Wimbledon's more like a spiritual experience for tennis fans, but even if you're just a sports fan, you got to go to the U.S. Open.
I'm glad you said I had more fun. Cool. As London-centric as I am, and I've gotten to go a bunch of times and have such good friends there, I preferred the U.S. Open to Wimbledon.
Yes.
I don't know if it's the... There's games at night. I don't know
it's
what
loud.
It is. Yeah, all of that.
I still love Wimbledon the most, just because it is the mecca. Mm-hmm. But New York is a party. Great food, things to do, things to see. I mean, every court is pretty amazing. So
you must have became very aware because you'd planned a trip to go anyway and didn't know if you'd do some work. But you had to realize that even that Sunday morning match against Carreno Busta, it's 11 a.m. start. But I don't know a person that wasn't watching it. And that's really something.
Yeah.
Sunday of Labor Day weekend at 11 a.m.
A fourth round match.
Yeah. Not against a huge name, although a 12 seed that's just kind of... been around, hanging around. He's been a top 20 player for a while. And so it didn't have the glamour of playing Nadal and Rogers Cup. But the prominence of Shapovalov from the attention from Rogers Cup, but also, as you know, and you and I would have been the same kind of obsessive person checking the bottom of the draw. And people early on, he qualified.
Yeah.
And when Andy Murray dropped out, you poked around and go, okay, Federer and Nadal are in the top half. And outside of Sasha Zverev, there's not really a thunderbolt of a threat that you'd say was if he could beat Tsonga. And I said that with Del Potro at the Rogers Cup, and he said, God, if he wins this match somehow, the rest is just found money. But no one had any idea how it opened up. And here we are taping. We still don't know. This could be a Kevin Anderson Rafa Nadal final. It could be Carreno Busta making. No one would ever have thought he'd make a Grand Slam final with his career.
Which is so nuts to think that even in the fourth round, that's what we were looking ahead at the draw and thinking Shapo, Denis could honestly go
he had
as
the best
far
odds.
As he wants. Yeah. He didn't play well against Carreno Busta, but it was still the three tie breaks and he really fought. I was impressed with how much he kept fighting, even though he wasn't playing well. But I don't know. Part of me thinks grand, big picture, maybe it's not bad that he lost in the fourth round, as opposed to getting onto the bigger and bigger stage and all that pressure that follows.
It would have been awesome to see. So
amazing.
It would have been
incredible. But in retrospect, I'm saying.
Oh, yeah. And again, being a touch older, I'm there front and center remembering Becker at Wimbledon, Chang at the French Open in 89. Mm-hmm. We had Mats Wilander on the morning show last week, which was awesome.
Yeah.
I loved him and Edberg
cool.
equally. But he won the French Open at age at 17 and 11 months, I think.
Which was different then. So different. And now it does not happen.
But you don't expect it. So you knew, being in New York City and then interviewing Dennis and feeling the vibe, a little air got knocked out of that part of the draw when he lost on Sunday. Mm-hmm. And people are so into him. It's nothing against the guys that have been there forever in the States, the John Isners and the Sam Querys. But I mentioned it, and I think it's true. He's the most beyond exciting North American player. There's not an American player, born player, that people are as excited about as Americans are as excited about Shapovalov, because they'll get him next year. He'll be 19, and he'll be one of the marquee, hopefully he's one of the marquee draws in New York. We know in Toronto next year he will be.
He'll be on the posters.
Carl Hale's doing handstands, and then you and I both probably saw Milos last night with Chris Fowler and John McEnroe.
I was just going to bring that up, yeah.
And we forget there's the number 11th ranked player who's been a bit injury riddled, and hopefully it all corrects itself with the wrist surgery he's had. And not that, look, I don't know that anyone will ever say Raonic is his brand of tennis is as exciting as Shapovalov. Mm-hmm. That'll be difficult to match.
Yep.
But the results may still, we can't discount, it may still happen. He mm-hmm. may still win a Grand Slam. He may make another Grand Slam final, because everything's up in the air. Where Roger is at 35, Djokovic's health.
36 now.
36, yeah. Djokovic's health and consistency. Andy Murray is going to miss probably the rest of the year.
Mm-hmm.
What will these guys, because once you take once you have that injury derailment, people thought Nadal was sort of done and dusted a couple years ago in terms of being a great player. People thought that with Roger 3 years ago. And so mm-hmm. it's a testimony to their all-time greatness that they've had the year they've had. But with Novak and Andy Murray, we don't know. And if those guys aren't what they once were, it's right there for players like Raonic to get back. And it's right there for top five. It's obviously there for younger players like Zverev and Shapovalov also.
This U.S. Open series, I think, was kind of a dream come true for the ATP, because this is the year that they started this ATP Next Generation, and they have the year-end kind of finals for Next Generation coming up in November. So I think just with the success of these young guys, Sasha Zverev, Denis Shapovalov kind of breaking through, it's best case scenario for the ATP,
yes.
who I think in the past year, as great as the Federer Nadal renaissance has been, it's also posed the question of why is this happening? Where is this next generation, and how come they're not winning yet? So it's good that we're headed in that direction, and we're seeing them already starting to win.
Dave Randorf from Hockey Night Canada is going to join us in a couple
yeah,
of minutes. But I think it's also worth mentioning, I'd love to get your take on four U.S. women semifinalists, all in the absence of Serena Williams, really picking up the torch. You know the criticisms that are there that are very valid when players like Wozniacki always seem to under-deliver. Some number one seeds like Dinara Safina, and we're hoping Pliskova is not that player, but she lost earlier than she should have to a good opponent also. But I think it's obviously really exciting probably for New York. Friday will be, when we get the podcast up and running, is the ladies' semifinals, and that's a great day for that country in tennis when it's outside of Serena. There haven't been a lot of landmark U.S.-born players achieving very much the last several years.
It's also great, too, not just the Americans' Final Four, but basically everybody that was in the quarterfinals on, is there's great comeback stories. Like Venus mm-hmm. at 37, still playing, still winning, fought through the autoimmune disorder. Coco Vandeweghe, she's been playing so well.
I like her a lot.
I mean, and she's fun to watch on the court. I think I'm talking to people just at work last night. A lot of people don't like her because she gets fired up really easily and starts complaining to the chair umpire, things like that. But to me, she puts on a good show. You have Madison Keys, who's fought back from injury and doing really, really well. And Lindsay Davenport's in her corner.
Mm-hmm.
It's really good to see. And then Sloane Stephens, who's had an incredible comeback. She was off for 11 months with the foot injury, and now she's been on a tear since she returned this summer. So I think that, too, is good for the sport to have those four American women in the Final Four in New York. I think it's really good, and I think I would love to try and see those players, especially the younger ones. I mean, Venus has been so consistent this year, but for them to continue to keep it up. Because from the summer on, they have been. I mean, Madison Keys and Coco Vandeweghe, they met in the Stanford final. So
you wonder about that with, let's say it's a final between, well, even the semis with Venus and Sloane Stephens, you wonder where the crowd leans because Venus has done so much. And she had, you know, obviously the off court accident this summer that is a terrible memory for her and always will be. Mm-hmm. She's put it behind her, got where she got to in at Wimbledon. I wonder whether the crowd would pull for the younger player. If Venus would play a Keys or a Vandeweghe, is it a very pro? As you know, this is the struggle. This would have been the struggle with a Federer, Shapovalov, Shapovalov. Yeah, like because it's no one anywhere ever would cheer against Roger or Rafa if they made a final. It feels like,
but
unless you had that great home, it has to be a national. It has to be a homegrown story.
Like Milos Federer last year at Wimbledon in the semifinals.
Yes.
Yeah. No. It's an interesting question. I don't know who people cheer. I think they're just going to cheer for a good match. So they'll want a three-setter on both sides. But, yeah, I love the U.S. Open. It's just that, again, Wimbledon's my favorite, but the U.S. Open, it's just kind of the start of fall, back to school. And right now, though, it's kind of like Christmas for NFL fans.
Very, yeah, yeah.
So Merry Christmas, Greg.
Yes, we're recording this tonight with New England and Kansas City starting on the schedule. It is a long season, but when you only have 16 games, the build-up, it's not like the winter sports where your team's playing three or four times during the week, and you can only get so high or low with wins and losses, and that's what's exciting, like a really short schedule in college football, even with 12 games.
Every game matters.
Every game matters, and when you feel like you start 0-2, there's always records. When you're 0-2, it's something like 24%. Only 24% of teams make the playoffs that start 0-2 that have ever made the playoffs. There's a lot of weird dynamics to it. It does feel more than any other NFL year, though, reading the tea leaves. New England is as universal a favorite as anybody's been in a long, long time. And they seem, because they're defending champs, because they came back the way they did. I think it's funny that New England's had 7 Super Bowls, and they've all been close. When mm-hmm. you think about it, like, look at that Seattle win, beating them with the Malcolm Butler interception.
Oh, yeah.
And everyone criticizing Pete Carroll for not handing the ball to Marshawn mm-hmm. Lynch, maybe rightly so. How close last year's game was, obvious overtime. But even the two losses to Eli Manning were both games that were, like, unbelievably exciting games in Arizona and in Indianapolis against the Giants. But, and so they've been the dominant team in all of pro sports for 15, 16 years, and they've never really had an easy time winning titles. There's always been adversity.
They've been an easy team to be a fan of if you're a bandwagoner. Even people who start as fans of one team, Miami Dolphins, will then switch over and cheer for the winning team.
Is that something? Yeah.
Sorry, who was your original
that
team?
I loved the Dolphins
was that
as a kid.
Your story? Oh, yeah. Okay.
My grandfather did nursery business with Christmas trees, and then he'd go down to Florida after Christmas. And when I was 4 or 5, he'd bring me these cute little dolphin cardigan sweaters and these little jerseys. I had a Bob Greasy jersey who's really, really old. So my grandfather, who's passed, was really, really old. But
anyway, so
I became a Dolphins fan and loved
the whole career
of Dan
Marino.
See, now
I feel bad for making fun of you.
No, I'm not going to get too emotional because they've been so bad and they haven't won a playoff game since 2000.
It's true. You've got to find happiness somewhere else.
But I don't want this to sound like it's a Yankees fan becoming a Red Sox fan. That's how much of a traitor I feel. And I only feel this in this sport, that I looked at the Patriots, I looked at how they do things besides the cheating stuff.
and
with Belichick and with Brady, I've just got this awe and respect. I think the San Antonio Spurs are like that, but I don't think anyone hates the San Antonio Spurs. And, you know, we had Matt Bonner on our podcast, like Greg Popovich, and you can not like how bristly and gruff he is with interviews.
But you're right. They're not hateable.
No, but New England is, wouldn't you say, among all, there's what, 122 pro sports teams? Name me a team that is sort of people are either hate them or love them more than.
It's always Boston teams.
It's the Red Sox would be that too.
Red Sox, yeah. Yep. It's always Boston.
Well, when the Lakers get LeBron James next year, and he plays with Lonzo Ball because you love his dad so much, you'll be right there with the LA Lakers next year. It'll be very much a love him or hate him experience.
Their Facebook show is now out.
But I understand not many people. Well, you're not alone. We're very pleased to welcome to the Point Taken podcast, which you can hear, of course, on sportsnet.ca, or if you're listening on iTunes, you already know where you're listening. Very pleased to welcome in Hockey Night in Canada broadcaster. This would be year number 4 for him behind the microphone here at Sportsnet. Dave Randorf joins us from his abode in the Toronto region. But boy, he called some unbelievable playoff games in the Edmonton Oilers' first run in a long, long time, and of course, longtime CFL broadcaster as well. It's great to have you on our little soiree here. You hockey people go away for the summer, and we never know if you're near civilization, if you're near Wi-Fi. You do a really good job of escaping. I envy that, Carolyn, and I envy that.
It's first of all, thanks for having me. It's wonderful to be on this podcast, and I'm looking forward to having a little chit chat. But I am very fortunate. In my previous life, career wise, I used to work right through the summer, as you mentioned, mm-hmm. covering the Canadian Football League, and so this is quite the luxury. I don't like to. I'm almost sheepish and embarrassed about it because it's so awesome. It's nice to have some time to get back with my boys, because I used to work all my weekends were gone. Labor Day weekends were gone. I was always in the studio or at a game, a football game. But I've had a great summer. Went to Europe. Took my sons on a baseball road trip and did some cottages and just was around as a dad to their ball players around here in the Toronto area. So that's a very busy schedule.
Where'd you go on the baseball road trip?
You know what? We built it around going to see the Blue Jays at Wrigley in Chicago. So what we did was we mapped out a bunch of minor league stops between Toronto and Chicago. Huh. So what I did was I looked at the map, and then I had to find out, okay, who's got a team, and then I had to find out, okay, who's at home in that particular week. So the itinerary was a Tuesday night in Midland, Michigan, to see the Great Lakes Loons. We actually, Carolyn, planned it to go this way to see the Lansing Lugnuts, who are in Midland. And we thought, okay, great, we're going to see Bichette and Guerrero play. That's the whole reason we, mm-hmm. we had started off with that. And then they went and sent them to Dunedin like about 2 weeks before we left. So we missed out on that. Then we went to Gary, Indiana, to see the Gary Railcats play. Who had planned? The Canaries. Who the heck were the Sioux Falls Canaries?
Okay, yeah. The rivalry continues.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, it was huge. I wouldn't necessarily recommend Gary for everybody. It was a little hairy, but we got in and out of there all right. And then Schaumburg, Illinois, which was just outside of Chicago. So 3 nights, 3 states, 3 ballparks, and then capped off with the Wrigley experience, which was my first time at Wrigley. And it was a very special weekend because, you know, we're all Jays fans. My boys love ball, and this was exciting for them just to be in Chicago, period. But it was half, I'm sure everybody's talked about it since, it was half full of Jays fans.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
To the point where a lot of Cubs fans remarked to me over the 2 days, the Saturday, Sunday games that we were there, the weather was perfect, it was excellent, and they were going, you know, we're used to other fans coming in, especially if, say, a rival comes in like St. Louis or something, but he says, you guys travel. This is, we've never seen anything like this outside of a playoff game where half of our stadium is taken over by the road team. And so it was a lot of fun. Sat out in the bleachers and it was a blast.
Amazing. Now I've probably, Carolyn's a world traveler of great renown, but I'm sure she just got back from jet setting to New York City to, you know, hang out with the big wigs and Denis Shapovalov and all that stuff. But I'm sure she's never been to, just confirm, because I have a really quick Gary, Indiana story. I just confirm you've not been to Gary, Indiana
I can
for
confirm
any.
I've never been.
And the odds of being assigned by Sportsnet there for any sports
never
story.
Say never.
Never say never.
Yeah.
The next Austin Matthews could come from Gary, Indiana, and then not Phoenix, Arizona.
Well,
so 1990, Dave, I'm doing my first baseball road trip with my dad, and we're going to go to Chicago, and we're going to go to Milwaukee, and we're going to come back through Detroit. But we're looking, we go on the long July 4th weekend, first mistake, and the second mistake, this is pre-internet. So, you know, with hotels, we're all smart, savvy travelers, and so are our listeners, and you book in advance. But we drive, and we're like, well, we'll just, like, we were like the three wise men. We're thinking, we'll just get a hotel. Nothing, nowhere. So we're going on the way coming from Michigan thinking this will be easy. On the way to Chicago, we're driving around Gary, Indiana, and we get lost. And we're instantly, as you know, it's about dusk on a Saturday night. And we're like, this wouldn't be, even though Michael Jackson and the Jackson family are from Gary and they made it out of there, It's not, it's not. I didn't feel like in 1990 it was the right place to book a 2-star ground floor hotel and feel and feel really comfortable about your existence for the next 24 hours. So we made it to like just outside of Chicago in Lincolnwood and checked into somewhere at 3 a.m. But it's amazing what you did before the internet with hotels. You literally had to make a phone call and speak to a person.
We didn't stay anywhere in Indiana either, or rather in Gary. It was in this suburb, you know, about 40 minutes away. And I was driving through the area going, oh my goodness. And then I parked my truck and I thought, and blocked it, beep, beep, and thought, well, hope that's there when I come out of this game.
Now I have Gary, Indiana stuck in my head from The Music Man.
That's right. That factors in as well. Now we're gonna a lot of stuff with NHL, but you also took a huge trip to Ireland. So people are gonna want to hear two things: one about the golf you experienced there, because you went with some buddies from the past and the present, of course. And you also, I was really envious because this wasn't just a Rogers Center U2 show, because everyone can put their hand up and say, "Oh, I saw U2 at Rogers Center," and I just went to Buffalo. But you saw them at the legendary Croke Park on this amazing Joshua Tree Transcendent Tour that they've been on. Tell us about the gig first, and then tell us how you got tickets for, because the lineup and the list for people who would want tickets for that would be immense. It's U2 in Ireland.
Yeah, it was a pilgrimage. I'm one of those nerdy U2 fans that belongs to the online membership, so I get the pre-sale notice. So wasn't
you're in the fan club, are you?
I am.
Okay, that's good to say.
I paid my $30-$40 I'm one of those guys. So it was the list that they announced the tour, and I'd already thought to myself, you know, I've seen him a lot, and I every time I walk out of a show, I go, "Cause that was good. I think that's the last time." But, you know, I saw them in Toronto for their what was it called? It was Intimate and Interactive.
That's right. Yeah, Innocence and Experience Tour. Right.
Yeah. And I thought that was a great show. I think that I'll leave it at that. Seeing as I was on the floor, real close. It was great. And then this comes out, and I started humming and hawing, and I was looking at the dates, and I thought, okay, well, how about I? It's a big summer because, you know, I had a big birthday. In fact, a lot of buddies had a, you know, landmark birthday. And I was thinking, okay, how about New York? And, oh, Boston would be good, you know. And then I started looking at the Europe dates, and then it dawned on me. And I went, well, that's got to be done, right? It's you know, let's do this. So I was doing a game, actually. This was in January, February at some point. And I was actually in Winnipeg to do a game, a Wednesday night hockey game on Sportsnet. And you had to, for the presale, get up on a specific day at 9 a.m. local time. So in this case, 3 a.m. in Winnipeg. It was 9 a.m. in Dublin. And I had to get up at set my alarm for 2:45. I got my presale code, which was like 27 characters long. I wrote it down in big block letters because, you know, who's alert at 2:45? I'll tell you, I'm not. So I got up in the dead of winter in Winnipeg and went online, got the tickets. I was back in bed at 10 after 3. I had four great seats, and I was so excited and emailed some of my buddies who did not know I was doing this, and told them, and they were it was like we were a bunch of kids. We were so excited, and that's exactly what the experience was. We were running around Dublin in the biggest U2 nerd convention ever, and we were willing participants in that. And it was great because it was like we were 20 years old again, but we had money. So it was awesome.
Yes, that's a big difference.
and it was a Saturday night, so you can imagine the weekend. The city was absolutely buzzing, and we literally met people from around the world who had come for this one night and only one show. And that is because, as you pointed out, Croke Park is it's hallowed ground. It is they only hold 3 concerts there a year, I'm told. And Coldplay had just played there. I don't think somebody else earlier in the year. So this was it. This was the last concert of the year. That's why they didn't do, you know, 4, 5, 6 nights in Ireland. Just one show. That was it. So it was amazing. And just to be there, the buzz. I've seen a U2 show before, but I must admit it was there was a little extra juice involved because it was As Bono put, we were in the croaker, and it was, I think, when Noel Gallagher was the opener, and he did a great set. It was almost like 2 concerts in one. for the price of one. And he said, thanks for everything, and enjoy the local band. And everybody went bananas. And it was special, very, very special. And that was my first trip to Ireland. And anybody who may be listening along with this, who's been there, will know that what I discovered, and that what a magical place. The people are incredibly friendly. It is very easy to get around, despite the driving on the other side of the road thing. I've got a buddy who's lived in London for many years, and so he did all the driving. And the golf was great. We played down in the south in a place called Cork, and we played around in Kilkenny at a gorgeous, gorgeous place called Mount Juliet.
Mm-hmm.
I must admit, the Mount Juliet experience was a little off because the pace of play was very poor. They put us behind some guys who couldn't play. Like about two or three groups were playing some kind of scramble. And, you know, Greg and Carolyn, you'd think if there was one place in the world where you're paying big money, where pace of play would come into, where the rules would be enforced, it would have been Ireland.
Yeah, there'd be a ranger hustling them along somewhere in a cart.
Not the case on this given day. But you know what? It was fine. Just the culture. Went to Belfast as well, which was very, very interesting. Northern Ireland. And when I was a kid, and when we were all kids, right, you'd watch the news, and Belfast was the craziest, most dangerous place ever.
Yes.
And because of all the troubles. And so it was fascinating to go up there and take a tour with what they call black taxi tours. When you go to Belfast and you stay in your hotel, they will arrange for a guy to come up in one of the black cabs. He's a guy who's grown up there, as they say, born, bred, and buttered. And he takes you through the neighborhoods where all the troubles were, where all the walls still are, and the murals of Bobby Sands, the hunger strike, and tells you his somewhat slanted version of the recent history. But it's amazing, and they want people to come up there and see and meet the people and see the city, and it was cool. And of course, you're very close to the northern coast, which is absolutely gorgeous, and we lucked out, got some amazing weather that day, and saw that. So so yeah, a full trip indeed, and now I'm ready to get back.
Yeah, I was gonna say that's a long way from North Delta, BC. And when I was working out in Vancouver, I got to work with some of the guys you used to work with at Sports Page, like Don Taylor and Craig McEwen and producer Dan Chomiak. And for people who aren't out west, I mean, Sports Page, I wasn't familiar with it as a Toronto girl before I moved out there, but it was the staple. It was the nightly sports show before there was Sportsnet, before TSN. When you go back home, do you still get asked about it a ton?
I kid you not. My last show was July of 1995. I worked on that show for almost 6 years, almost to the day. And before I was hired away to move over to TSN, and I was also doing the pre and post game on CKNW Radio, where Jim Eusen was the voice of the Canucks.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, it was I without word of a lie, I don't go more than 6 months to this day without somebody somewhere, not even just in Vancouver, but maybe somebody who used to live in Vancouver and now lives in Halifax or Montreal, going, and they go, man, that Sports Page, that was the greatest show. You guys had so much fun. And we did. And it was really, honestly, local sports, 11 o'clock, full half hour, locally produced. We didn't just do Lions and Canucks and all the teams. And for a brief period, Greg, the Grizzlies, remember them?
Yeah, I was going to ask you about them. I was going to ask you what it was like with I find people, and Carolyn can confirm this, are somewhat resentful of the Raptors. Maybe we think they don't like anything to do with Toronto, but they're very resentful of the Raptors, kind of because the Raptors survived and the Grizzlies didn't.
Yeah.
And wins and losses and Steve Francis, it all had a lot to do with it. But it just must, man, I'm sure they see you have full arenas somewhere in the NBA, and people in Vancouver go, my God, we would love a second chance at this.
Now, I mean, the population has changed drastically since the time the Grizzlies left to now. It was multicultural to be back then, but I think Carolyn, who's recently lived in Vancouver, would attest that it's even more multicultural now and more varied. And it's not just a one-horse hockey town by any stretch anymore at all. So I think you're right. I think they would have a much better go this day and age. And you know, the NBA, what I remember that whole situation was the NBA really kind of threw both teams an anchor with the expansion draft rules right out of the gate.
Yep.
And they couldn't have a top pick for the first 5 years, I believe it was. Because the Orlando Magic got lucky out of the gate and got the first overall pick and drafted Shaq, and they were off and running. And the rest of the NBA didn't want that to happen again that quickly. And so the best they could do was second, and they got some players in there. Sharif Abdul-Rahim, remember him?
That's right. And, very good, yeah.
Abdul-Rahim, yeah. And Big Country Reeves, who was drafted at a draft in Toronto, by the way. It was I remember coming to Toronto to cover that one. And
high schooler Kevin Garnett goes the pick before. So you're going, yeah. if only we had a ton. Now, who knows that they would have taken them, but at least the option's there, right?
You're... But it was a struggle for a lot of different reasons. And the NBA's just kind of bailed on the whole thing. They really did bail. You know, you say what you will about Gary Bettman and his reluctance to, you know, give up on markets that we here in Canada don't feel fit to the hockey profile. He doesn't give up on them. You got to at least admit that. And the NBA bailed on Vancouver. There's no question about it. And you wonder what it would look like today. But anyhow, we had them for a brief period of time. But getting back to sports space, it was fun because it was a total local show. And I think people appreciated that we didn't just cover the pros, but we covered the local sports and told those stories. And I remember telling some great local stories of even some people who went on to great heights. I can remember going out to a high school basketball tournament at St. Thomas More. It was an invitational. And we heard about this kid from Vancouver Island who played for, I think it was Mount Douglas, I believe is the school. And he was in grade 11. And I came back to the office there and popped in the tape and talked to Don Taylor and the late Paul Carson, my boss. I said, this kid's like really good. And it's going to be interesting to see what he does at the high school championships. And then years later, Steve Nash was a 2-time NBA MVP. So his very first big time interview was with me.
And I assume you kept that? Do you have that somewhere?
You know what? I don't. Oh. Well, he remembers it. I know he remembers it because we chuckled about it at the Olympics years later in 2000 in Sydney. He walked into the studio and said, we're a long way from that gym in St. Thomas More now, aren't we? And I've got lots of fun stories like that, and big and small, and great, great memories from sports page days, including, a run to the Stanley Cup Final in 94, which was kind of out of nowhere. And any Vancouver fan listening right now, and especially of around my age, will attest. I know they made it to a Stanley Cup Final, of course, recently, but the ride in '94 was really amazing because it was, first of all, they were an average team at best, and they had a big win against Calgary, and then they beat the Leafs, and the Leafs were totally looking past the Canucks.
That's right. Yeah,
it was like a fait accompli that the Leafs were going, and all the media reflected that, and then the whole final in New York against the Rangers and the comeback and the game 7, all that stuff. It was fun. And Vancouver had never really experienced anything like that before at that real level. So it was fun to kind of be around that.
I think Kirk McLean has to talk about that run every single day of his life.
It's a contractual obligation. Yes.
Yeah. Well, game 1, 50 saves at Madison Square Garden. I was there. I was assigned to games 1 and 2, so I flew all the way out there. This was a huge budget thing for us. I mean, we're a little station in Vancouver, and I remember doing a bunch of streeters leading up to it and for my color piece, and all the people in New York went, what is a Canuck? They had no idea who the Canucks were or where we were from, this was just a speed bump on the road to ending their, 54-year curse of Stanley Cup lore.
Well, I want to get to some Canucks thoughts, some Alberta team's thoughts. I'm going to ask you about the Jets because you've done a good chunk of Jets games now. Like I said, heading into year 5, calling games on Sportsnet and CBC. I would ask if you think there's an urgency for the Jets. It was incredible them getting the team from Atlanta. Everybody was super excited. Not that the story came out of nowhere, but it moved fast once it moved from Atlanta. And one time in the playoffs, no playoff wins, and now they watch the Alberta teams on a bit of a crest upward, especially Edmonton. What do you think Jets fans will feel? Because there is that, hey, there's a honeymoon period with a lot of things, right, in life and work and whatnot. How urgent is it that the Jets begin to get tangible results in the Western Conference?
Oh, I don't think there's any question. I felt the Jets underachieved last year. They blew 8 to 10 points easily on nights when they let leads get away. And you know, I hate to point fingers just clearly squarely at one area, but goaltending was an issue. Mm-hmm. Goaltending was a big issue. They, you know, had Andre Pavlik down in the minors. They still believe in Connor Hellebuck as a guy, a piece going forward, but he is a young goalie with not a lot of experience. So again, I don't want to, you know, necessarily blame him, because he had some spectacular nights as well, where he probably got them 2 points where they didn't play well enough. But there was no question that there were some goaltending issues and some back and forth, and Michael Hutchinson was in and out and all that kind of stuff. So they feel they've addressed that by upgrading with Steve Mason, and we'll see how that works out in Winnipeg. But they've got a lot of interesting and intriguing parts. I think I don't know really if people knew that Nikolaj Ehlers was going to be this good. He is spectacular. All the talk about Patrick Laine and what he is going to bring in the years coming, he's going to be spectacular for sure. A true elite, big-time sniper, game-breaker, but Ehlers is fantastic. Mark Scheifele has quietly joined the ranks of the elite. You know, if you canvassed a lot of, you know, 10 to 20 knowledgeable hockey fans and said, name the top 10, you know, scoring forwards in the – make top 5 scoring forwards. Actually, no, you'd have to round it up to top 10 right now. Young guys in the league. I bet you'd be hard-pressed. Some guys would probably leave Scheifele off the list, but he has become a very reliable guy in the middle for them, and is a huge building block going forward. They've got some nice veterans. They've got some good pieces on the back end as well. Bufflin is you know, another year older, but he's still a force, and Jacob Trouba is a very good piece back. They've got a lot of pieces. What they need now is to put it all together. And for the longest time last year, they couldn't win 3 in a row. And that's the type of run and consistency that they were consistently inconsistent.
Yeah, yeah.
And if they could just straighten that out and believe in what they have in that room on a more consistent basis, I definitely think they could challenge for a spot in the West, because the West isn't nearly as tough as it once was, you know, 2 or 3 years ago, where it was a fait accompli that there was, you know, you could scratch 4-5 spots right off the, you knew that the Chicago's and LA's and Anaheim's and San Jose, that they were in, and that's not necessarily the case right now. So the opportunity is there for the Jets to get in there and join this party, because the spotlight is being stolen by the teams in Alberta right now out there.
Well, and all the talk kind of headed into this season in terms of young Canadian teams is obviously the Leafs, and seeing what they can do now that their rookies are no longer rookies. And then, of course, the Oilers, and to see how far they can get. And it seems like people aren't talking as much about the Flames, who had arguably one of the best off seasons of anyone in the NHL and made their blue line even stronger. Do you think this battle of Alberta will be closer than some might originally think?
Oh, yeah. And we're going to find out on opening night what it looks like right off the bat. I mean, imagine that. If, you know, you play 5 times, and those are 2, you know, important points. I just cringe at whenever anybody says, it's early. It's no, 2 points right now. Look at it when you're scrambling for those 2 points, where a fan is desperate for those 2 points in March, or, you know, in the last week and a half of April. So these 2 points on opening night against Calgary will be important. And I'm not saying it'll be playoff intensity on October 4th, but it'll be an important game. And I know that Calgary is disappointed in how the rejuvenated and renewed Battle of Alberta went last year, where they were swept and beaten badly, actually. We did back-to-back Saturday nights in January, and they were smoked. And but there was definitely a feel in both cities that rivalry was back, not only in Alberta, but I think a lot of people in Western Canada, and I think in Canada, hockey fans in Canada were glad to see it back. Of those back-to-back games, I remember the first game we went in on a Saturday night, and it was, I don't know my notes in front of me, but it was something like, it was the first time where both Calgary and Edmonton had been in a playoff position that late in a season for over a decade. So it was special to have it back, and there was a lot of hype and everything else, but it didn't work out for Calgary. But they both made the playoffs, and it's, as you point out, Carolyn, the Flames, they clearly know what Edmonton has up front, and they have started building their team from the back end out. this offseason with the new goaltending and a bolstered defense with the addition of Travis Hamonic to an already good defensive top four. And they've got some strong pieces up front as well. And they just re-signed Sam Bennett. They are going to keep him at center ice. So, you know, they've got some real depth up the middle. Whether or not he stays there or not, we'll have to see. But, they do have some good punch up front as well. And they are clearly building themselves to, you know, get in the way of the Oilers. And they're not giving up the fight. And I think it's going to be very interesting to see these two go at each other as the season goes on. And that rivalry is back.
Well, Dave, you did a bunch of Oilers playoff games on the network. You saw three things I want to talk about. The Leon Draisaitl, really a coming out party for him. They beat the Sharks, to remind people, in the first round in six games, the defending conference champs, and then really a series that flipped on a coin and had some controversy to it with the Anaheim Ducks in the second round. So you see Draisaitl coming up, but I'd ask, too, about the struggles that Jordan Eberle had and Ryan Nugent-Hopkins had. Now Eberle with the Islanders, but Nugent-Hopkins back. And if you told people those guys would play 26 combined games and neither would score, nobody'd believe that. Similar to Draisaitl being, you know, not that he outplayed McDavid, the circumstances are different, but if we look at outplay and outperform, and perform is about points, he did. He was fantastic.
Mm-hmm. First of all, with Draisaitl, he was 21, he's going to be 22 in October. So he's still young. Last year was just his second full season. And this is a big hulking guy with speed and skill. And he was put up on that line with McDavid, but I think the long-term vision is, and we'll see how this develops as the season goes on. Clearly the long-term vision is for him to be a 1-2 punch at center ice behind McDavid. And it's just scary to think, feels a lot like those great teams, say, in Colorado, where you had Sakic and Forsberg following each other, and you just not many teams are equipped to deal with that. So, we'll see whether or not he starts with Connor, or whether they start to ease him into center ice position. But to me, this guy is worth every penny that they gave him for that 8-year contract, and something that they had to get done. And it's great that they could get him to a long-term commitment. And he's happy knowing that, McDavid is the guy and it doesn't turn into one of those situations. He's very proud of where he came from. A guy, from Germany who is going to easily, and in fact, already is well on his way to being their best hockey export ever. He's very proud of that. And I think that work ethic shows day in, day out. He's a young man who speaks very well. I've spoken to him many times. He's very mature, and he understands the responsibility that he has and that the team has. And with this new building and the salary, the money that these guys are now making, he gets it. And he went through a bit of a lull to start the playoffs because he was sick. And, but by the end of the playoffs, he was there. He was the guy carrying the mail again. He's proven that he can carry more than his share of the load and take a lot of the pressure off of McDavid. And that is going to be a tremendous dynamic duo to watch for the next 5-6 years easily. The things that they can accomplish leading their way up front is going to be amazing. As for the other guys that you mentioned, Ryan Nugent-Hopkins was a first overall pick that, I think a lot of people painted as a guy when you're drafted that high and you're given that much money that Craig McTavish gave him and that much term, you expected 80, 85, maybe 90 points out of those types of players. He morphed into a different, more complete player last year and had this conversation with their coach many times. He got a lot harder to play against in corners, won a lot more puck battles, was better in the faceoff circle. He did a lot of other little things that you don't necessarily see on the, you can see through analytics, but you don't necessarily see in the goals and assists. I don't think they were necessarily overly disappointed in the season that Nugent-Hopkins had. I think that they now know what they have in him. Mm-hmm. This is going to be a guy who is going to be more of a 200-foot player and not necessarily an 80-point guy anymore. In the case of Eberle, I don't know what happened there. He went long stretches where he could not put the puck in the ocean. He hit posts. He hit crossbars. And there were times when, he seemed to lose his focus and wasn't battling hard. And I think the trade to the Islanders is the best thing for both parties. It's one of those things where I think maybe a change of scenery could do both people the world of good, because he gets a fresh start, you know, probably get to play with John Tavares, which is going to be, you know, anybody would take that. And he's away from that fishbowl that is Edmonton. And, you know, he was one of those, that young core of all those high picks that had never played in the playoffs up until last year. So he wore that. And it's not like he didn't care. Jordan is a guy who, you know, Western Canadian himself from Regina, and he gets it. And he it's not like he didn't care at all. That wasn't the problem. It's just that his goals dried up. He did hit the 20-goal mark again, but I think he got about six or seven, like, in the last couple of weeks. So he moves on, and they you know, they can start slotting guys where they need to be on those top lines, because he was getting minutes, quite frankly, near the end he didn't deserve. And so he is still a guy who can score you 30, and I think you will see him get back to that range with the Islanders.
When you get set to call games this year, and it's kind of coming into the last few weeks of summer, how do you start prepping? How do you kind of start getting ready to go back to school?
That's exactly what I do. I go back to school. You know, it is a nice time to take a little recharge time, as we were talking about at the top of our podcast here. But once Labor Day passes, certainly time starts ticking away. I've got a preseason game next week in Vancouver. In fact, I got a whole new team to learn for that one.
Yeah.
In Vegas. So I've got to. You basically just go back over. I've kept a lot of press releases and notes. I make notes when news comes out, make point form notes as the summer goes along. And then I go back at this point and start going, okay, that's right, this guy went there. And I start shuffling. Every guy has their own system, but every guy has kind of a roster sheet. So you got to rearrange all those. And I just update my own notes. I go into every game with kind of a bullet note sheet on both teams. And that I've kind of come up with on my own recent news, or what they did last year, or how they compare in this statistical category to the next. And I also go in there with my roster sheet, which is, you know, names, numbers, heights, weights, stats, little notations where they were drafted, all that stuff. And just make sure all that is all updated and ready to go. And then you just read from this point forward, you just read, because there's no games to watch yet. And a lot of the preseason games, quite frankly, you are seeing a lot of guys that aren't going to be there when the puck drops on October 4th. It's good to kind of get your eyes on the game again and see maybe who's playing with who. But it really, for me, starts once the real games begin. You can take a little bit of the preseason action, but not a ton, because more often than not, there's a lot of shuffling that happens once the real games begin. But a lot of reading, Carolyn, as you well know. You're both excellent broadcasters in your own right, and you better stay current in this day and age. You got to be up on it, and because everybody else is, it's a different time than those sports page days when the sports fan didn't have as much access to all the information, and it's become such a diverse fan base in a sense that people understand the game and consume it at such a different level. Now there's all these analytics and different levels of stats in hockey and baseball and in whatever else. I don't necessarily, as a play-by-play guy, get into all that. I just kind of keep it down the middle of the road and call the game and let the color guy do his job and let the studio break it down with the analytics. But you still need to be aware of if a team is good on face-offs and possessions and if they're being outshot and all that kind of stuff on a consistent basis. So there's lots to keep up on. But generally, you know, I watch a game or two every single night. And if I don't watch it on at night, I PVR it and go through it the next day. So yeah, it's even when I'm not calling a game, you're on the job.
But it's amazing the internet's changed everything, where you have to be better, because you just nailed it. Everyone around you, either someone else will step in and they will have done more work than you if you don't do the work. And certainly the fans have that interactivity thing where, you know, you have a slip in a live broadcast, radio, TV, whatever. And, you know, it's good natured usually, but it'll get pointed out. Whereas 40 years ago, I don't know how.
No, it doesn't get pointed out.
I swear, once or twice a year, I get a mailed letter with a stamp on it, telling me I did something wrong. It's that instantaneous. But yeah, you think about, I mean, how long Bob's been doing this, or watching Ron Hewitt, Foster Hewitt. I know how much Jim Robson must have meant to you as a kid, and you go, the envy you have for those guys doing that then in a pre-internet world. But that's why the conversations matter. You mentioned talking to Todd McClellan before games. Mm-hmm. Getting the access is still, it's still really valuable to find out kind of the story behind it. And it is something that if I'm watching you do a game with Gary Galley, you're having conversations I'm not privy to and the fans aren't privy to. And that's still the value of it, really.
That's the one area where fans, you know, where we've got the leg up on the fans who at home sitting there think they know everything, and they know a lot. I'm not saying that they don't. But yeah, I have sat in Todd McClellan's office that morning, just him, I, and most cases, Wes, Louis DeBrusque, and probably Cassie and Scott Oak, and probably the Oilers radio two guys. And yeah, and he's one of the coaches that's very forthcoming, and tells you a lot of stuff, some of which you need to filter because he trusts you, and you earn that level of trust with coaches around the league, and you can shape and form your coverage that night around you know, what you know, without giving away more than they want you to. So there is that, and the other balancing act that I kind of work in my approach to it is to not get too bogged down with all of the information. I mean, at the end of the day, you just want to watch the game. I don't like being bombarded with a whole bunch of statistical information or stuff. And my approach is to be a little bit more meat and potatoes and certainly be aware of everything if, in case it becomes a trend that you need to point out over the course of a game. But that just wasn't the way 10, 15, 20 years ago. It wasn't like that now. But it's a more sophisticated audience, and you have to give them, that type of aspect in your coverage as well, without going too overboard and all you hear is my voice or Louis' voice, because sometimes it's nice to hear the skates and the puck and the stick and the crowd as well.
Yeah.
I find sometimes in broadcasting that what we as broadcasters might have considered our best show or best game isn't necessarily one of the most memorable nights in sports. For you, what's been perhaps a call of a game that stands out to you the most, whether it was a big moment or whether you were just kind of on that night?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, I guess, you know, the first thing that comes to mind is I've been very fortunate now to have worked a few Stanley Cup playoff games, and you always want to be on there because every goal could be potentially a big one. And I've done a couple of overtimes as well, and you always want to be on there. I've done a couple of Game 7 overtimes, as a matter of fact, so that's been exciting. And you really feel as though you are on it. You feel like, I don't want to overstate it or anything like that, but you want to be as sharp as the players when that time comes. When you got the puck on your stick, so to speak, in the booth, you want to make sure your eyes are right. And when Derek Stepan scores to knock out the Washington Capitals and he's on the far wing, you better be damn sure it was Derek Stepan. And thankfully it was. So, there's moments just like that. I think just the excitement of being around playoff buildings is for fans, for players, and broadcasters. It's all the same. So you get that adrenaline that you bring to your call, but you don't want to be too overboard. You don't want to be shouting right out of the gate, because you have to leave room to expand as the game goes on, particularly if it's an elimination game or a game seven. I did have the great privilege to do a lot of international hockey and overseas for world championships in my years at TSN. I did about 11 or 12 of those. And to be overseas and call gold medal games that Canada was in, that's cool. That was, I really remember those days an awful lot, because it's fun to hear old Canada in Moscow. You know, and when they get the gold medal, and there was a goal by Rick Nash. He scored one goal and against Finland in a gold medal game that gets replayed all the time, and on TSN. And I just remember that moment and just being almost a little bit. It's hard to put your Canadian ism aside for moments like that. You have to, and you should be. But moments like that, it's fun to be around and to hear the Canadian national anthem in places overseas when it's just about five of you who've gone over from the network to cover it. You know, there's about a million people watching at home. That's a lot of fun as well.
That makes me think to ask you where you think the World Cup of Hockey's going. I'm really curious because in Toronto last year, never mind like the secondary ticket market or the fact that Canada just looked so dominant like they did in Sochi, but you'd be like me. The Canada Cups were, I love them. I love the format. I love that they're in the fall, late summer. Even when I was starting university, 91 was the Canada Cup when Gary Suter cross-checked Wayne Gretzky, and we were all outraged as a nation by that. But in 87, I'm young for 72. I really wasn't around. Carolyn, I don't think you were either for 72, but I could be wrong.
That?
But yeah, exactly. So where do you think it goes? Because I can't tell if I loved it, Dave, because I was a kid. I can't tell if it was the political intrigue. Or I can't tell if it was just cool because we were less dominant. So when we'd win, we'd really, like, you don't want to be blah when we win a major best-on-best championship. But the last fall felt a little that way. I don't know where it can go, I suppose.
I think, to me, I agree with everything you've just said. Different time. We aren't, we were, back then we weren't inundated with, like, every game wasn't on TV. So it was, as it is now, throughout the course of the season and the amount of coverage. And so this was, it seemed a little more unique and a little more special. Not to say that a best on best, as you pointed out, isn't something as a hockey fan that you shouldn't sit back and realize, okay, this is cool, but I should watch this. But I think also combined with that was that Canada was just so damn good and so dominant. And so stifling at their last, Olympics and World Cup of Hockey that it almost, there was no barn burner 6-5 games.
Right.
Like in 1987, there was none of that. It was pretty quiet in terms of the back and forth. I don't want to say fait accompli, but did anybody think Team Europe was going to beat Team Canada? No. Now that is the way, that's the way the cookie crumbled in that tournament. And then full marks to Team Europe and Ralph Kruger and that band of hockey players that came together. A tremendous accomplishment for them, but hard to sell and hard to get fired up for. I think you would imagine it wasn't like Canada, Sweden, or Canada, Russia, or of course Canada, USA. So I just think I can't decide whether or not it was more special back then or not either. But now that we don't have an Olympics to look forward to with pros in it, with the NHL in it, I mean, I'm still going to watch the Olympic hockey tournament for sure, but clearly it's not the same deal. Now that we don't have that, then this may, to me, nothing replaces an Olympic gold medal.
Mm-hmm.
This is not on the same level, and no player will say that either. But if you don't have that to look forward to, then maybe this will get a little bit more hype and a little bit more respect next time around. But listen, all those memories that you brought up, especially 87, was incredible, right? I mean, there was so much hype around it and so much excitement around that. I remember I believe it was the last game against Russia in the 1987 series, where I was at a Jays game with some buddies. I was going to Ryerson at the time, and we were at Old Exhibition Stadium, and the Jays were playing Baltimore in a nothing game. And it was cold and wet and rainy, and we were thinking, what are we doing here? And we ran as fast as we could to the Wheat Chief Tavern to catch the rest of what was, the last half of what was, a remarkable, unbelievable game. And my favorite hockey call, by the way, of all time, is the Lemieux goal by Dan Kelly.
Dan Kelly was amazing. Yeah.
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 Yeah. So I just don't sense that was the case here. I think there still is a little bit of a notion out there amongst fans and some media that this is a bit of a money grab and that they're just lining their pockets and they're really not playing for their country and all that kind of stuff. And I don't know whether that's unfair or not, but I know that's how some of my buddies feel that live in the Toronto area when it came to buying those tickets. And so, it was only one time. They did have a lot of players come out. So let's see what happens once they do this down the road in a few years, and we'll, especially if the Olympics aren't back.
Now, we've used so much of your time, and you've prepped to do, like I said, for the Edmonton Oilers.
I'm so busy.
Carol. How their face offs. Well, you've refilled your cappuccino probably a couple of times, but the let's ask you that the CFL is rich and deep in your blood. We had James Cebulski on out in Vancouver for them to get ready for the big Sportsnet 650 launch, and we said, people must come up to you, Dave. I mean, you've been at some incredible CFL games and done the panel, done play-by-play. You're at the 13th man game. And they say, why is the West so dominant compared to the East? And this year, here's a stat for you. They're 19-3-1 in crossover games. Like that's like a Nick Saban Alabama record. can you pinpoint at all this year, any year, why it just feels like that power balance is so... It's not tilted. That's on its head. Do you ever have a good answer when someone asks you? Because I don't.
No, this is not new.
No, it's not.
It's not new, and I can't tell you how many times I sat down in our production meetings with Matt Dunnigan and Jock Climie and Chris Schultz and our producers, and later Milt Stevo when he joined the fold. How many times we had this conversation, and we brought it out on air many times about what our theories were. Whether it was does the atmosphere bring out in the West, I think it's fair to say that the atmosphere in games in Edmonton and in Calgary and in Vancouver when they're rolling is just more. Does that bring out more passion in the players, and does that or is it the time change when the Eastern teams go out there and look at everybody's record in Vancouver? It's terrible. Mm-hmm. Is it and every team has tried different ways to go out there 2 days before, 1 day before, all that kind of stuff. Imagine playing a football game at 10:30 when your body thinks it's 10:30 at night. We've gone up and down this thing, but it's one of the great mysteries in North American sports, really, because it's not like teams in the East haven't gone out and gotten good players and tried to, Montreal was very good for a long time, but even they didn't have a dominant record out in the West when they would go out there. And in fact, if you probably look over the past 10 years at the overall record of the East versus the West, a lot of those wins probably came from those Anthony Calvillo years. You take them out of the equation, it gets worse. So I have no good answer for you on this one, but it's really too bad. And I really do think that we are overdue in the Canadian Football League to throw out the East and West and just go with one big set of standings, 1 through 9, and then have the top two teams get byes to the semifinals, and the rest of them, 2 or 3 plays, 9 and so on and so on. I know what you're risking there. You're risking, the playoffs losing its East and West identity, but you've kind of already lost that anyway because of the crossover. I mean, it seems like a regular occurrence now that you have a Western team coming over the East semifinal and playing in the East final. And that happens all the time now. I mean, look at it right now. The first place team in the East is below the doesn't even have as many points. The first place team in the East.
That's right.
Doesn't even have as many points as the last place team in the West.
Yeah. Well, and I'd be, as we tape this, and people will, in Ottawa who listen will yell at me, they are the defending champions, and they were 8-9-1 the regular season, beating a fifth. Like, people were talking, as last November, are the Stampeders the best CFL team ever? And it's hard to be that if you don't win the Grey Cup, but that was the talk going into the playoffs.
I know, and it's unfortunate on your biggest weekend. So you're talking about that and how can, it just, I get a little testy.
Yeah, I can tell. I like it. I like it.
I love the league. It was, I loved it long before I was associated with it from a media standpoint, but I still watch a lot of the games and keep up, but it's unfortunate when things come up like that, like, oh, geez, of course, it's Canadian Football League where a team with 8 wins can, not only go to the Grey Cup, but win it. But, it's the old adage that you just get into the playoffs and anything can happen, and it does. Having said all that, it is not good for the Canadian Football League to have year after year this imbalance between the East and the West. I don't know what the reasons are, what the theories are, that there's good players in the East as well, but they just can't seem to. The stability and consistency of the organizations, particularly in Calgary, and now Edmonton has returned to form. You know, they went through a few years there where they were down near the bottom. But Wally Buono certainly brought more stability back to the BC Lions. They were flailing about for a long time. That hasn't translated to big crowds week after week on a consistent basis. But the consistency from the front office standpoint, from John Hofstadter in Calgary, Wally Buono in Vancouver, and now the group that they have in Edmonton. With Jason Moss as their head coach, and Saskatchewan is Saskatchewan. Even when they aren't, successful in the standings, they are successful in the stands. That's the fact of the matter, and that's always a tough place to play, no matter what. So, especially now with that new stadium rocking the way it is. But I have got no good reason, no good answer for you. We have discussed it ad nauseum and run every theory, but I do think it's time to just go with 1 through 9 standings. And take the spotlight off of the imbalance.
I'm with you. And now that we got you all riled up, we'll just let you go.
Okay, fine. But listen, it's been great to have you on be on with you guys. Yeah. And thanks for having me. And I'm looking forward to talking to you as the hockey season goes on.
Yeah, no, thanks so much for your time. We really appreciate it. I think I speak for all Canadian hockey fans that I'm really excited for this season.
And he's coming back in a year when 5 Canadian teams made the playoffs. That probably riled him last. Hey, what's with no Canadian teams in the playoffs? And you're like, don't get me started.
Oh, geez. I was there. I called the game in November of that season when Carey Price got hurt.
Oh,
it was in New York. He didn't come up for the third period. It was with Gary Galley. And that was the domino that kicked over everything in Canada. It really was. You can trace it back to that night. And that season 2 years ago was Greg, Carolyn. I can remember signing on Saturday nights in January and February for meaningless Hockey Night in Canada games across the board. It was tough.
All this allowed you to call a dramatically exciting Islanders-Panthers playoff series. And you may never have an Islanders-Panthers playoff series experience again. So life's all about those experiences, right?
Do you have time for a quick story on that one?
Yes, sure. I do. Yes.
When Carolyn asked me earlier, I guess I should think about this. People ask me about calls, but I got one. I got a story.
That's it. Yeah.
That was, you're right. It was
great.
I was right in the middle of a 3 games in 3 nights. I got lucky scheduling wise. I was bouncing back and forth between Chicago and St. Louis. And that one, I did that game 6. I think it was a Monday night. And so the story going in was the Islanders had not won a playoff series in over 20 years. I want to say 23 years.
I think it was, it was 93, Dave, when they knocked out Pittsburgh. That's it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So anyhow, that was the big story. And here they were at home, well, in Brooklyn, and they got a chance to finally, slay this dragon and get it done. And interesting, on NBC, you had Ray Ferraro was doing the color on that night, too. He's between the benches, and he was on that Islanders team at last one. So he was interviewed, and we showed him, too. He was standing beside Gary Galley. Anyhow, you can cut it with a knife in there. It's 1-1. If I remember correctly, I think the Islanders were actually down 1-0, and it was game 6, so they weren't going to get knocked out, but they did not want to go back to was it game 6 or game 5, Greg?
Game 6. It ended 2-1 Sunday night win. Yeah,
that's right. So I want to say that they had to come back in time. They forced overtime. So any play-by-play guy out there who says that whatever line for a big goal, an overtime goal, says that and comes up with some kind of line, and didn't think about it, 99% of the time, he's lying. He thought about it. So I'm thinking, okay, what am I going to say here? And I got nothing. All I know is that this is a big deal, and the place is packed, and everybody's nervous. And the line that I eventually used was, Tavares scores, we have Bedlam in Brooklyn. And I get asked about that a lot, and every once in a while I'm where I came up with it. So I had nothing going into the first overtime. I couldn't think anything. The intermission seemed to go by in a heartbeat. And so first overtime comes and goes. There's some chances, but no goals. So I have to run up to the men's room in the intermission between the first and second overtime. And in Brooklyn, in the what's the place called? The Barclays Center. Mm-hmm. There is no press box. There's no gondola hanging over the ice. You are in the crowd. So I go up the stairs, and I'm in the concourse, and I race into the the bathroom there, and the concourse is full of guys from New York and Long Island and Brooklyn, and they're all wearing their old school Islanders jerseys, Trache, Gillies, Goring, Bossy. It's and you could just, like I said, you could sense the nervousness from everybody because they need this to happen tonight. It has to happen. And so I'm standing there at the urinal. Sammy's some huge guy who looks like he's right out of The Sopranos. Big guy. He's like twice the size of me. Big old boiler on him, stuffed into this Islanders jersey. And he goes, "Hey, buddy, you having a good time tonight or what?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "It's a pretty good game." He goes, "God, I got to tell you what, the Islanders, they got to do it tonight. They just got to do it." I said, "Yeah." He goes, "I tell you right now, if Tavares scores in here tonight, it'll be freaking bedlam." And I stand there, taking a leak. I looked at him and I went, "That's it!" And I ran back to the booth and I wrote it down, bedlam in Brooklyn. So that's where that line was inspired, at the urinal, standing beside Tony Soprano.
And that gentleman is now a low-level, rising-up-high executive at Sportsnet. Scott Moore said, "I have to have this guy on staff," and it went accordingly.
Well, you never know where those lines come from, and that's where that one
came
from.
This is why you're there speaking to millions every Saturday night, and I'm here. I'm here with Carolyn,
hey,
so it's good.
Yeah.
But I would have yelled out "No Sleep Till Brooklyn," the Beastie Boys song. But that's why you're there and I'm here. It really is.
That wouldn't have been bad either.
Yeah, I might have heard from King Ad Rock might have got a hold of me with that one. Wonderful to have you on. We wish you a great preseason, and obviously we, like the rest, will be watching and very excited for all the games you're doing all year long.
Thanks, buddy. Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me on, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks.
This happens every year, but I feel like you're just enjoying your summer, la-di-da-di-da, and then bam, hockey talk suddenly starts. It's just been in the past week and a half.
That's right.
Even days, actually, that everyone's talking about hockey.
And you'll, on the television side, you'll start showing, like, rookie highlights and people arriving at camp. And then there's, oh, you must love this, the big news story is the team golf tournament.
Oh, yeah.
You have to interview players at the golf tournament and get a read on what they think their season's going to be like.
Those types of clips are my nightmare for writing what we call an on-camera. So when I'm on camera before throwing to the clips, because they're not really
That's right.
So-and-so's getting ready for the season, blah, blah, blah.
And nobody really, it's also...
They're not saying anything.
And they're all in good shape. So it's not like somebody's like... gained a ton of weight, like, you're not, oh my goodness, he's let himself go and a lot of dough products he was eating at the CNE every day or something.
You've been talking
like
to Dallas Agans.
Yeah, there is okay. That yeah, it's not like they've done an Ironman 220k bike marathon or anything like that. But the other thing is, they'll all be very, I mean, 15 teams logically, 15 teams will be better than they were, and 15 teams will be worse. That's the math. But everyone is going to say that they think they're better because of getting this guy or that guy.
Like,
I don't know if you have friends who are diehard Leaf fans, but there's a panic among a couple I've talked to, despite all the optimism, despite the fact all those young kids are a year older, and it'll be the second year for Anderson, third year for Babcock.
Sophomore slump.
There's a panic that they'll be not as good last year and struggle to make the playoffs because they didn't clinch till the 81st game last year. I can't see it beyond injuries because everybody, all logic says they should be better.
I'm no psychologist, but I call this Toronto sports trust issues, where people aren't used to nice things, right, and good things. So when something is good... it's too good to be true. Something has to go wrong.
Yes.
But I honestly don't think it will. Knock on substitute wood.
And it's too bad. It's not like, Toronto FC could win the MLS Cup, but there's still be that Toronto FC fan based on the first 7-8 years that you won't believe it till you see it.
You don't want to get your expectations up to be disappointed, because that's what you're used to.
The Jays were like, I always think about having people over that Thanksgiving night when they were down 2-0 to Texas in 2015, and just thinking, how ridiculous. They go on this amazing run. They trade for David Price. They trade for Troy Tulowitzki. This will all be gone in three. They could get swept tonight in Arlington, and there's your little Blue Jays playoff experience. And it obviously went so much better and so much differently. Then there's no bad flip game. There's no amazing run to the ALCS. There's none of that without that one moment. So you're right. The trust issues
are there. What could
and
go
the Leafs
wrong,
especially.
A lot could go wrong.
Like, the Jays have two World Series titles. You'd have to be 58 years old or more to remember the Leafs in a Stanley Cup final.
The issue too, and I blame we, the media, as well, because we do need things to talk about. But the issue, especially in Toronto sports, is people just jump on whether things are going poorly or if they're going really well, right?
That's fair.
So there's just an immediate reaction that's usually always over the top.
That's very, very
fair. So let's all just take a breath, maybe go to a yoga class, and enjoy the ride.
Yes.
Everything will be fine.
Like how Zen Dave Randorf got about it, the CFL, the West-East thing.
Yeah.
He was like,
stressed out right now. He's probably being quite productive, going to the gym.
If we tapped in
some steam.
If we'd been able to tap into his cholesterol and blood pressure during that answer, we wouldn't
There's
have
an
liked,
idea.
We would not have liked the readings one way or the other that we ended up getting back. But we can end it on a lighter note because we haven't done this in a while. We want to roll in with.
What up with that?
That is what exactly we could do right now.
Okay, so you sent me a story. We always send the night before we do a podcast, we send our ideas to each other.
Or about 10 minutes before, let's be honest.
It depends on the day.
Yeah.
So it is, and you're going to have to correct me when I intro this story because this is yours. So it is being redone, a Stephen King film.
That's
right.
That's right. About the clown.
Right. I don't like scary movies, so I haven't seen really any of these.
You won't be attending it.
No, but there's a list out of his worst movies. It's a top 40 list of worst to best.
Yeah, no, worst to, yeah, they rank, yeah, 40 being the least palatable to watch.
Right.
There are some bad ones. But I preface this by saying I grew up very much in the culture that just consumed Stephen King. In fact, I remember buying Pet Sematary, and my dad found a swear word in it, and he, like, thought, like, I basically could have been... It was like I had a nudie magazine or something. He, like, threw it out. He's like, how can you read this garbage? And it's not like my dad is some preacher. He's this liberal. But I was 12, and there was a lot of bad words in Pet Sematary.
Never seen it.
And he threw it out.
Never read it.
You don't... If you have pets or... If you ever have intentions of pets and or children, Pet Sematary is not the right movie for anybody.
Okay.
I don't know who it's for, really.
So I can confidently say this top 10, I don't think I've seen one. The Running Man? That comes
yeah, that's a Schwarzenegger movie.
1987.
Yeah, I liked it. It's okay. That's about ranked properly.
1408.
Don't know it.
Came out in 2007. John Cusack.
Oh,
so
okay.
I know. Who specializes in the paranormal and insists on staying. You lost me. I'm okay. That's
just
next.
From the word paranormal, we lost you.
It, the 2017 one.
So it's really good. That's a good review for it to already be ranked that high.
Yeah, I still don't see it.
Okay.
Stand By Me, 1986.
A classic, no question.
Yeah, that's a non-horror, right?
Yeah, you would like Stand By Me. There's leeches involved on boy's skin in the river.
Great.
Anyway, I don't
mean
to give anything away
there. Swim in Lake Ontario.
Yeah.
Six, Creep Show.
Hated it. Didn't like it at all.
1982.
Nope.
Won't be watching that. Misery.
Amazing, and I'm telling you, you would
Kathy
really.
Bates,
that's
right?
Kathy Bates won the Oscar for that. James Caan is amazing.
You know
in it.
What? Maybe I've seen parts of it.
It's not
on TV.
Gross. It's meant to be what I would call a. I'm sure you've seen. There's a difference between a horror movie and a psychological thriller, and that's what Misery
that's
is.
That's fair. I really
Give it a
like
go.
Kathy Bates too.
Well,
Shawshank.
I went on two like those sort of Toonie Tuesdays when I was a Western student to see Misery. And being at that movie on a Tuesday was like a concert. People were yelling and screaming. With the Kathy Bates character involved. I don't want to give
it
anything
away. Was that Western film, like you would go to the theater on campus?
No, but I've done that. I have done
They have
I love
a
Western
popcorn.
Film.
Yeah, they have a popcorn trough. I love popcorn, and it's not a bag. It's a gigantic trough.
So
it's disgusting.
Sanitary-wise, yes, you're still here to tell
well,
about
no,
it.
Well, no, but you eat it with a friend, not with strangers.
That's true. That's
anyway,
also true.
I digress. Shawshank Redemption. I'm shocked I've never seen that. That comes in at number 4.
Yeah. Very, very good movie.
Dead Zone.
Holds up remarkably well. That's Anthony Michael Hall did the TV series called The Dead Zone for, and I really never gave it a go, but it's a great, great movie.
Carrie, I've never seen.
I hate
I know
that. I hate that. Now I can't argue with the critical acclaim of it, but I hate it because it's kind of frightening and gross and sissy. See, I haven't been able to unsee Sissy Spacek as Carrie, so she's an amazing actress, but I only think of her in Carrie, and I get super creeped out by her.
And the last one that I will never see in my life is The Shining.
Are you sure?
Yeah, I don't.
What do you feel?
I hate scary movies.
Did that turn on a dime for you at some point, or at any point, do you have like nightmares? Did any? You know, I'm getting very personal here.
I just don't like to be scared.
But
no,
at some point, when
never...
did you realize it? Because everybody goes on a roller coaster and then they're like, oh, I don't like that. Or
well,
they
that
had
I
a
don't
point...
like because of heights. But I just don't. I love movies, but why would I want to see a really creepy, scary movie?
To make your adrenaline flow, and like a Halloween haunted house doesn't strike me as your
no. I'd rather do something else.
Okay. All right. I'm not going to try and change you in one podcast or 15 or 16 of them.
Yeah, whatever we're at. Yeah. So the summer box office was officially the worst in over a decade. People apparently this summer not going to movies.
And you are one such person, or you are? You went and saw Wonder Woman, and I think you saw a couple
Wonder
other
Woman,
movies.
And that was kind of, yeah, what else did I see? I have to say, though, and we've talked about this before, is I don't see as many movies anymore since I started working nights many years ago, because I don't really go see movies during the day. But my question was going to be, are less people seeing movies, or was it just that there weren't the greatest movies out this summer? Wonder Woman I loved.
Yeah.
And other than that, I was not... On a nice summer night, I don't want to go see a movie.
I think it's a little bit of both, but I think everybody, because you can make the TV viewing experience, like we used to go to movies because it was a better setup than everything we had at home. But when you go to somebody's house and they have all this surround sound and a giant screen and they put a movie on, or obviously you're watching a sporting event and you get together, it's what could be better than that? But the movie, I think it's the social thing the movie replicates. But my wife and I don't, we're like, I got better ideas for us to spend $45, and it's the trying to find time to just be out together. You'd rather go to a restaurant you hadn't been to before,
well,
or go for a walk, or do other stuff. And yeah,
movie.
It's very, you can be quite antisocial, I suppose. But then you can talk about the movie after. I still think it's still very much a first date, second date. As long as there's dating, there will be movies.
Awkward,
I think,
though,
to some
you're
extent.
You're not really talking. Dunkirk I saw this summer, too. I forgot. I really enjoyed that. And I'm going to try and go see some TIFF movies. Now, I haven't looked online to see the cost or availability, but there's some. There's the tennis movies I want to see.
That's right.
Do you know if the Vince Carter movie's at TIFF?
It is, because we interviewed the director on the show today.
Yeah, okay. Well, maybe I'll go try and see that.
Yeah. That's going to have a lot of... Because we were talking about Vince and how polarizing he is, and there's still people that are just forgiving him. Kind of forgiving him, but we're amazed by his impact, but just devastated to see him want to leave, you know?
And I was surprised by this last one that you emailed that you seemed quite passionate about.
Right. This, we've seen a lot, some celeb breakups, like everybody was upset. Chris Pratt and Anna Faris busted
that
up.
That actually was.
So
I hate any.
Look, if it's like if you had a friend and you say, oh my goodness, that relationship ended. And I think especially when you hear like, kids are involved and whatnot.
Yeah.
But this is an odd one, only in that now we've seen visual evidence. It was rumored for a while that Jamie Foxx and Katie Holmes were and now still currently are a couple. And I want to pull for Katie Holmes in this relationship. Like, I want this to work because I feel, I don't know whether you have a personal thought on Tom Cruise, but I'm like, how did that happen?
Yeah, that was a shame.
What on earth kind of scenario? Because the whole,
jumping on the couch thing.
That and the whole Scientology thing, it makes everybody feel, you know, to each their own, but makes everybody feel a little weird. Because you would have thought Katie Holmes, normal person from a small town in Ohio. I know
you're
that.
You're really dedicated to this story and to Katie Holmes' happiness.
I was a Dawson's Creek viewer. I don't know if
same.
You were.
Yeah,
okay,
Joey.
So there you are. So you pull, but there are certain couples, you're like, it would be bad, you would hate to hear, like, Sean Penn and Madonna breaking up, you're going to laugh. I like both those people, I like both them as artists,
and I
wanted it to work. They were both a little volatile.
How did we get here?
Haven't you had that?
I actually really dislike Madonna.
Oh, no. Give me a celeb couple really pull for.
Chris Pratt and Anna Faris, I was really pulling for.
Okay. So,
I used to be more into celebrity gossip than I am now, though, so.
Did you have because I've talked to women before who really don't like Angelina Jolie and really love Jennifer Aniston, so they consider Angelina Jolie this strange home wrecker with the Jennifer Aniston, even though there were no children with Brad Pitt and Jennifer Aniston, and now Brad and Angelina had like 11, and then they broke up this year. It's the year of breakups.
Yeah, you can't just... Yeah, well, who's the common denominator there? I mean...
Well, maybe...
Hello?
Yeah.
Brad Pitt. You know who I'm always pulling for is George Clooney in Amal.
That's
she
a good one.
She seems like a classy...
Okay.
I like her. Smart.
I hope those two catch
like
a break. They've just had nothing but hard luck in their careers.
Yeah, they're not very good looking either.
Yeah, I mean, I really pull for them.
Yeah, same. Life's hard.
I just want something to bounce George and Amal's way.
I find this Prince Harry, Meghan Markle thing quite interesting, too. I'm keeping an eye on that.
Now, can
I love the royals, and I grew up with a Prince Harry poster on the back.
So I'm glad you brought that up. Is the concept that Meghan Markle, Canadian, Is she complaining a little too much? She knows there's going to... Why?
She's
she knows there's
going to
be attention and photographers are going to chase her around.
She's actually kept quite quiet, and now this is
look
really
at
the
you.
First
no,
interview
here comes
on
the,
Vanity
oh,
Fair.
Oh, my goodness. But she's like, it's... I got the sense it was like, oh, my God, it's so hard dating Prince Harry. I thought that was...
It is. It would be.
Why?
Because how would you feel if everyone was up in your business? How would you feel if you left this studio?
Just follow me around the Rogers...
yeah.
I should talk.
Following you around into the Rogers gym and, you know, interviewing your family.
Well, I told you about... I mentioned Dave Randorf, too, sleeping in my car for 2 hours. I don't think I mentioned it on the podcast, but I got back from U2 in Buffalo, slept 2 hours in the car. And these
here,
three,
in the parking lot
yeah,
here.
These three construction guys arrived in the morning.
Yeah, and they probably thought you were dead.
And I popped the trunk of the car. The thing comes up, and it's the first car I've ever had where the trunk comes up automatically.
Oh.
And I emerge from the back of a car at 5 in the morning.
Wait, you were in the trunk sleeping?
Well, I pushed the seat out. I'm alone. I'm fully dressed, and I get out of a parked car that was been sitting there, and these guys are like, it's a little like an alien landing. But I mean, I can imagine if Bob McCown did that, or Stephen Brund, or you know, like I'm able to do that. I have that anonymity. If you do that, people are going to think there's something really wrong with Carolyn Cameron sleeping in the trunk of a car for 2 hours. I was able to pull it off, no problem, no questions asked.
Did you say anything to
I don't
these
know.
Guys?
Not really. Just kind of dusted myself off and. Went up and did a short radio show.
You know what, though? I overheard you saying it to, I guess, Dave Randorf before we started the podcast.
Yeah.
But I'm with you where I would rather sleep in the trunk of my car than some of the couches that are hanging around.
Because it's no security concern, but security people do walk around the building, as you know, really late at night.
Yeah.
And I don't want one of them standing over me going,
no,
who are you and why are you on our couch?
You'd rather than see you in the parking lot.
Again, far more recognizable
honestly,
people than me might get left alone to sleep.
They'd think you're dead in the trunk.
Yeah, but I'm not. It's not like, you know.
But you know what I'm saying about the couches? Like this couch around the corner.
Big time. Yes.
Even sitting on it, I'm like, this couch has been here a while.
It's probably had some activity. And I don't mean illegal or immoral stuff. It's just had a lot of people laying on it at some point in time. My car is fairly fresh for 3 weeks old.
Ben Ennis sometimes, I don't know if he wants me to tell people this, he sometimes naps in his car.
I wonder where he's
before. I don't know what if it's P1 or P. Is there a preferred...
P2's are great. It's
P2,
like a hotel. Yeah,
yeah
you upgrade.
There's not as many.
Yeah.
Yeah, not
you don't
as many.
Get, you don't get points for sleeping in the parking lot here. You don't get reward points that you can use later on, like Marriott points or anything like that, but it's a start.
What a strange business.
Well, we're glad you're back from New York City. You'll enjoy the U.S. Open. Do you have a women's prediction?
Oh.
You got this amazing story.
I'm going for Sloane, but I think Venus is going
to
beat her.
I want Madison Keys to win.
Sloane or Keys.
I would be so fine with Sloane.
Yeah.
You know me in new blood. I'd love that concept.
You know, former coach of Madison Keys, Jesse Levine, was a podcast guest on here.
Well,
I forget if we talked Madison
Keys. He'll have
Keys.
To come on
did.
Again if she wins the U.S. Open on Sunday.
Yeah.
Thanks for...
I think I'll go have a nap.
That's right. In the parking lot. look in various cars. You might see Carolyn somewhere.
Yeah, please don't.
Rate us on iTunes. We'll see everybody next week, deeper into September. Week one of the NFL season will be over. I'm sure we'll get into more on that. And, of course, closer to hockey season and the U.S. Open finally put a bow on that. And the Grand Slam season, technically. Have a great weekend, everybody.
See ya.
You've been listening to Point Taken with Carolyn Cameron and Greg Brady on sportsnet.ca/590.